Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Jimmy Akin here with us this hour for a full hour of open form. Your calls welcome on any topic, 888-318-7884. Open form is open to anyone and open to anything, especially when Jimmy's here. We mean anything. 888-318-7884 is the number call, 888-31-TRUTH. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of a whole bunch of things, including A Daily Defense, 365 Days to Becoming a Better Apologist, which is now a podcast. You can find out about that at Catholic.com. He's also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kellett, host of Catholic Answers Live.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate so few people give you the full respect of your name and title.
Yeah.
What do we got dropping tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Tomorrow we have part one of a two-part look at the paranormal practice of dowsing, where people use sometimes they may use rods or sticks, but they or pendulums, but they try to find items' locations through psychic means. The classic version of this is looking for water so you can dig a well on your farm. And dowsing has been very popular for a number of hundred years. It's actually used in a lot more ways than just finding water. Even back in the day, they would use it to find minerals like iron or gold. Today, they use it to find oil, and they use it to find missing people and diagnose medical conditions.
Wow.
So there's a lot of applications for it. There are a couple of special things about the look that we're going to do at dowsing. One of them is I have a guest who is himself a dowser. He's Dr. Paul Smith. He was one of the government's original remote viewing psychic spies in the Defense Department's Stargate program.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things they found with remote viewing is they could view the target, but they couldn't tell you where it was. And so they use dowsing to supplement their remote viewing efforts. And so he's going to be talking about his experiences using dowsing as part of the Defense Department. The other thing that's kind of special about it is when we look at it from the faith perspective, wow, there is going to be a big surprise.
Really?
Yeah. I was very surprised when I dug into the Catholic Church and its history with dowsing and what the Vatican itself has said about dowsing.
How interesting. Oh, I'm looking forward to that because I tried it as a child. I have no idea. My brothers and I must have seen something on TV about it. So out to the forest we went with a stick that looked like it could do the job, and then we dig a hole. I don't think we found water.
Did you find anything?
I can't remember finding anything, but it was an adventure for a day trying dowsing. Is it always using a stick, or can you use – are there –
No. There are other forms. The classic stick that people see being used is called a Y rod because it's shaped like the letter Y. There also are rods that are shaped like the letter L, and they're called L rods. Pendulums are also used for dowsing. And then there's what's known as deviceless dowsing, where you're not using any device. You're just using your own body.
Oh, all right. Well, I'm very interested in the faith connection. I'm interested to hear what you came up with.
That'll be in part two of the discussion.
Mysterious.fm is where you can go, or you can just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and you will get there. Hundreds of episodes now available. Tomorrow, dowsing. I'm a bit surprised. I had forgotten all about dowsing, but I'm looking forward to hearing about it. And is it practiced everywhere? Like, is it kind of one of those things where it's kind of ubiquitous? People have.
Well, it's historically it's been used in Europe, but these days it's spread all over the world.
Gotcha. All right. 888-318-7884 is the number here. When Jimmy's here, the lines fill up quickly. As a matter of fact, I can tell you they fill up in less than 5 minutes and 30 seconds because that's what they just did. We got a full set of phones, so off we go to those phones. Our friend Emma in Hayden, Idaho, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Emma, nice to have you back again. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. So I've heard the answer a million times, but I'm kind of dense, so I need to hear it a million more times. When it says in the scripture that Mary did not know Joseph until, because that's the word my Protestant friends are hung up on. And I've heard, like, he rose again. You know, please explain it to me so I can tell them logically.
About Jesus rising again. Jesus rising again, or Mary not
being a virgin.
Until
Mary being a virgin.
Okay, yeah. Well, in the Greek text of the Gospel of Matthew, it does use the word haos, which is an equivalent of the English word until. In English, the word until frequently implies a change of state. So if you say, I stayed at work until 5 o'clock, that could suggest I left work after 5 o'clock. And that change of state is common, but it is not universal, even in English. To give an illustration of that, in the Old Testament, King David had a number of wives. The first one was named Michael. And Michael had, at least at a certain point in her development, a kind of some airs of haughtiness. You know, she was married to the king. And at one point, David is bringing the Ark of the Lord to Jerusalem, and he's caught up in religious fervor, and he dances in front of the Ark. And she viewed that as a common, unroyal, unregal thing to do. She looked down on David for the fact that he danced in front of the Ark of God. And we're told by the inspired author that as a result of this, she had no children until the day she died. Psychelet. Does that imply that she then died and started having children?
I finally know I'm going to get this one right. No, she did not have any post-death children.
Okay. Well, I and most biology textbooks would agree with you. So this is an illustration of how even in English, until or till does not automatically imply a change of state. So we have to look at what else we know in a given case in order to find out, was there a change of state in a particular case? And when we do that with the Virgin Mary, we have other evidence, including from the New Testament itself, that indicates that she did not have later children. So, you know, we frequently review that here on the air. I won't go through it all. One thing I will mention is that what is true of English in this regard is also true of Greek. Heos does not automatically imply a change of state. And we have early church fathers who were Greek speakers, like St. Jerome, who translated the Bible, saying that. They confirm that because this verse was discussed in the early church as well. I believe if you go to jimmyakin.com and look in the library and search on Jerome, once you're on the library page, I believe I have excerpts from St. Jerome where he talks about this. Also, at Catholic.com, I know we have discussions of this. You can just type in Mary until Matthew 125 or the word Heos, H-E-O-S, as well as Perpetual Virginity, and you'll get a bunch of resources for free right there online at Catholic.com.
Emma, thanks very much. I appreciate you starting us off. We've got lots more folks on the line, so we'll take our first break and come back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Hosting Women Made New has helped me deepen my own faith, and I look forward to every weekend having those in-depth discussions with my guests. It's been such a blessing being a part of the EWTN family and carry on the mission that Mother Angelica started.
Women Made New, Saturday noon Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. I have no guarantees, but I'm guessing there'll be a little bit of groovy music in our future, and it's open forum. That's what we do around here on Thursdays, and it's fun to do it. If you'd like to get involved, if you've got a question about the Catholic faith or anything else, give a call, 888-318-7884. Going next to Boise, Idaho. Aaron in Boise, Idaho, listening on, Boise, Idaho. I don't know what I was thinking. Aaron, I apologize. I know it's Boise, and I get in trouble with the people of Boise whenever I say Boise. Listening on Salt and Light Radio.
Aaron, you know what's causing that?
What?
In English, when we have a letter S between two vowels, it is frequently pronounced like the letter Z.
Oh, so it's just,
and so yeah. So if you have the I and the E in Boise, and there's a tendency to apply the S to Z rule. That's why we say Jesus, not Jesus.
Oh yeah, right.
And because it's between two vowels, it's an intervocalic S, it tends to be pronounced as a Z, at least in many circumstances. So a person who's not a native of Boise will look at that and say, oh, it should be pronounced Boise based on the intervocalic S.
That is exactly what it is. So Aaron, I hope you will forgive my intervocalic S. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, that's quite all right.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about the topic of universal salvation.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, the book, That All Shall Be Safe by David Bentley Hart. If I may, I'd like to just rehearse the argument as I understand it, and then I'll ask my question. Is that okay?
It's a call-in show, so it's got to be kind of quick, Aaron. Not too long. Go ahead.
So basically... A human being is a rational creature created by God with will and intellect. A person's will is only free if he pursues those ends which are proper to the will, which is the good. A person cannot be said to be fully free who ultimately rejects the only proper end, which is God. Therefore, it is impossible for a human being to freely will his eternal separation from God. So my question is this reasoning sound? If not, where does it go wrong? And if it is sound, why does the church teach that a human being can choose to go to hell?
Okay. Let's take the second question first. The reason that the church teaches that a human is able to go to hell is because we have very good scriptural evidence for that. There are multiple places in the New Testament that indicate that not everyone, that indicate at a minimum that hell is a real possibility for human beings and that it's based on the decisions that they make in this life. So we have good evidence that humans are able to make the choice to go to hell. In terms of the first question, I haven't read David Bentley Hart's book. I'm aware of it, but I haven't read it. So I can't comment directly on it. But based on the way you summarized the argument, I would say that when the church talks about freedom in terms of pursuing the good, it's describing the proper exercise of freedom, that one is being fully free if one is doing this. One is being fully free in the way that is intended if one is pursuing the good. However, that doesn't mean that we don't have a kind of freedom that would allow us to choose sin, because obviously in this life, we do choose sin. People choose to commit adultery and murder and tax fraud and all kinds of different sins. So we clearly have the kind of freedom that allows us to commit sins in this life. It's a misuse of freedom, and by committing the misuse of freedom, it damages our freedom. And as St. Paul describes it, we can become slaves to sin where our freedom is diminished. But But we clearly do have the ability to choose sin, including grave sin in this life. And consequently, the line of reasoning ultimately doesn't work, because just because we have, if it proved anything, it would prove too much. If the line of reasoning is sin, freedom simply is choosing the good with no possibility of varying from choosing the good, then we wouldn't be able to commit sin in this life, and we obviously do. So the fact we can commit sin in this life strongly suggests we might then die in a state of grave sin. If we can choose grave sin in this life, there's a real possibility we may die in a state of grave sin in this life. We're not guaranteed a repentance. And consequently, hell remains a real possibility consistent with the divine revelation we have.
Aaron?
Okay. I've been really trying to find a way to refute this argument, and I find it very challenging. And my thoughts have sort of gone in that direction that you suggested. I still find it a challenging argument, though.
Well, I would suggest thinking about what I just said. In the future, I may have the opportunity to read the book, at which point I'd be able to comment more precisely on exactly the way David Bentley Hart constructs the argument, but at least based on the summary, that's what I would say.
Aaron, thanks very much. Appreciate that call. I'm going to keep moving because all the lines are full. Off we go now to Mesa, Arizona. Josh in Mesa, Arizona, watching on Catholic.com. That's our website, Catholic.com. Josh, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Last night I had a dream about upside down crosses. So every room I went to, there's an upside down cross. So I wanted to see if there's any meaning behind it, if it was, you know, a demon or the devil, you know, trying to take a visit to me. So just any insight can provide.
Okay, so let me ask you a follow-up question. Has there been anything else going on that would suggest anything out of the ordinary?
No, the most recent event, just my twin daughters got baptized, but nothing out of the ordinary that I can think of.
Okay, congratulations.
So, my guess is, if I'm getting closer, thank you. If I'm getting closer with my family, you know, with the Catholic faith, with my kids, you know, the closer I get to God and my family, maybe, you know, I don't know. So that's what I guess it's kind of perplexed and not understanding
okay.
it.
Well, here's how I would approach it. The first thing I would say is that the upside down cross is an ambiguous symbol. Although for some people it may be an anti-Christian symbol and thus could be consistent with the demonic, that's not its automatic meaning. In fact, upside down crosses are specifically associated with Saint Peter, because according to tradition, when St. Peter was crucified, he didn't feel worthy to be crucified in the same manner that Jesus was. And the Roman authorities obliged him by then crucifying him upside down and with his head towards the ground. And so the upside down cross is actually a symbol of St. Peter and in the history of Catholic iconography. So it's an ambiguous symbol. It doesn't automatically mean anything anti-Christian. So that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say concerns the nature of dream symbolism. Now, dreams can communicate to us in a symbolic way that contains messages from God or from the devil or from wherever. But that's not most of the time. Most of the time, the imagery that we see in dreams seems, and at least this is the attitude that's broadly accepted in the scientific community, most of the time, the imagery that we see in dreams is non-symbolic in nature. It's just our subconscious reprocessing elements of our daily waking experience in certain ways to achieve certain goals, like helping us learn how to deal with stressful situations, so we have stressful dreams. And it could simply be since you're growing in your Catholic faith and you just had your daughters baptized, maybe the cross was on your mind and your subconscious decided it's time to have a stress dream so that we learn how to handle ourselves in stressful situations. And so what would be stressful to Josh? Well, he's religious. Maybe we take a cross and we turn it upside down and we copy and paste it all over his dream. And that will be stressful for him. And so he'll get a stress dream and learn how to handle stress. So that could be all there is to it. In terms of the demonic, the demonic operates kind of on a spectrum. There is at one end of the spectrum kind of the background ordinary operation of demons, you know, where they tempt people to do stuff, but they're just one source of temptation among many. It's not like every temptation comes from the devil. Classically, the three sources of temptation in theology are the world, meaning the example of others, the flesh, meaning our own disordered desires, and the devil. And the devil's just one of those three, and not necessarily the most active of those three. We see a lot of bad example, and we've got our own internal desires that we have to live with that can tempt us. So the devil's not even necessarily a big factor there. Then at the other end of the spectrum, you have situations where it is manifestly obvious that the devil is involved because you've got a full-blown possession with an alternative personality that's extremely averse to pictures of Mary and Jesus and is doing projectile vomiting and levitating off the bed and throwing 300-pound men across the room. And it's very obvious in that situation. And then there are situations that are kind of in the middle where it's debatable. Well, as long as it's not clear that the devil is involved, and you need more than just a strange dream to say the devil is involved, as long as it's not clear that the devil is involved, it's really not worth worrying about. Because, you know, what are you going to do if you think the devil's involved and it's not enough to go get a full-blown exorcism? Well, then just say a prayer and let it pass. If a devil really is involved, actually focusing on that could make it worse. So I would say just put it aside, and if other things accumulate, well, maybe you want to revisit the idea. But for now, I would say it's probably just a stress dream and not really worry about it beyond that.
Josh, I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you very much for the call and the question. It's open forum, every line full, and off we go to Missouri. Joseph in Missouri, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Joseph, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hey, Jimmy. My question is, so I was reading an article on Catholic.com, and it was talking about, it was like titled, Woman in Combat, Contraria Naturum. And it argued that it was immoral for women to be in the military, basically. And I was very convinced by the arguments. Then I went on the USCC website a little later. I found something that was like they were talking about conscription. They talked about having the military an option for women. Now, it was by the administrative for like the administrative team, so I don't think it technically had like bishop magisterial weight. I'm conflicted because on our sources, I've been seeing that argument and things like that. So I was wondering if you could draw some light on that.
Okay, first of all, where was it that you encountered the claim that it's immoral for women to be in the military?
On Catholic.com, there were two articles about it. The one that actually made the argument was Woman in Combat, Contraria Nature. I'm sorry, that's Latin. I may have mispronounced that.
That's okay. I know what it means.
It was basically argued that it's contrary to woman's nature to end life since they are oriented to producing life and giving life.
Okay.
So, well, the first thing I want to do is compliment you on recognizing that just because something is published by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, that does not make it a teaching document. You have to, it does not make it a document of the magisterium. There are substantial requirements that have to be met in order for that to be the case. And so it's great that you're aware of that fact. Would that more people were aware of the difference between what is technically a magisterial document and what is technically not. In fact, this week I just got done recording a course for the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics on that subject. So that'll be coming out. But I'm not familiar with the arguments, with the articles that you referred to, and so I can't comment on them directly. What I can say is that there is a long history of women being involved in the military in one capacity or another. There have been military nurses for a long time. There have been military who were women. There have been military secretaries for a long time. And if you look back in the history of just America, you won't find a lot of Americans having problem with those roles. But then there's the role of women in combat, which we'll talk about more after the break.
Right back with more with Jimmy Akin. Open forum on Catholic Answers Live.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
In These 12, The Gospel Through the Apostles' Eyes, best-selling author Rod Bennett gives a riveting re-examination of gospel events from the ground floor perspective of Christ's own hand-picked successors. In his trademark storytelling style, Bennett movingly depicts what it was like for the apostles to witness Jesus' teaching and miracles up close. Why did he call them, and what did he intend for them to do? Order your copy of These 12 today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
There it is, a little bit of groovy music. Now it feels like a Thursday. Jimmy, groovy music, and open form. Those three things make me feel like it's a Thursday. And then after I leave sitting in traffic for a ridiculously long time, those three things make me feel like it's Thursday. Joseph in Missouri is on the line and essentially just asking Jimmy, is it moral for women to serve in combat roles in the military? Jimmy?
Yeah. So when it comes to combat roles specifically, I think we have to distinguish between what's preferable and what's absolutely mandatory. Sometimes in discussing policy matters, a policy may not be preferable, but it may not be intrinsically evil. And I think it's pretty easy to show that women serving in combat is not intrinsically evil. There have been numerous situations in history where, including Jewish history, where an opponent is, let's say, attacking a town, and the town does not have enough male members to defend itself. And so even the wives of the male townsmen will join in the fight because they need to protect them and their children. And if the men are not sufficient to protect the town, then the women need to help. And that's been recognized as a legitimate situation all the way down through history. Similarly, let's just scale it down to a very domestic setting. Let's suppose that you're at home, you and your wife and your kids, and an axe murderer breaks in. Or it's some other kind of home invasion. Maybe they got more than an axe. Maybe they got a gun. And maybe there's enough people participating in the home invasion that you yourself are not able to effectively defend your entire family against them. Well, in that situation, it's perfectly legitimate for your wife to join in the fight in defending your children in your home. And so that's a woman in combat, and that's legitimate. Now, one can certainly say women are oriented in a special way towards childbearing and giving life, and that's certainly true. That's why in cultures across the world, throughout history, it has been overwhelmingly men who have performed the function of warfare. Men are built by nature to be stronger, especially upper body strength, and to have the kinds of skills. They're better at spatial relations, which makes it easier for you to attack and target an enemy. And men are built to be protectors and defenders in a way that women are not. Men are built for combat more than women are. But that doesn't mean women can never, under any circumstances, engage in combat. And so I think it's pretty easy to show that it's not intrinsically evil for women to serve in combat, but it is, in a sense, contra naturam, contrary to nature, at least the way things are normally should operate. Men are designed for combat in a way that women are not, and so it makes it appropriate for men to perform that function in society. Now, I haven't read the piece pieces that you've discussed, but I would assume that that's essentially the policy they're recommending. They're recommending the what would be the preferable policy, but that's not the same thing as saying under no circumstances whatsoever can this happen.
And you know what? I think I'm just going to leave it there and say thanks very much for the call, Joseph, because I am realizing the time and that there are, well, that every single line is full. So thank you for the call. I do hope that that was helpful to you. I'm going to go to Betty in Dixon, North Dakota, listening on 101.9 FM. Betty, thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you for taking my call. Do you believe in the book The Warning by Christine Watkins?
Well, it's a whole book. And so I would need to be a little more refined than just giving a yes or no, because there can be things in the book that are true and other things in the book that are not true. But in general, I do not have a lot of confidence in that book. I am aware of it. I have it. I've read it. And the reasoning and the data that are used in the book are not high quality. To cite just an obvious example, the book is in part dependent on a lot of unapproved apparitions. And one of the unapproved apparitionists in it is named Father Michel Rodrigue. He's a Canadian priest who claimed to be a visionary. I did an investigation of him on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I believe it's episode 123. For episode 122, the immediately preceding episode, I did a look at the so-called warning or illumination of conscience that the book is about, and I concluded the evidence for it is actually not good. I mean, I can't rule out that God might one day give a broad-based illumination of conscience to people in the world, but the evidence that he will do such a thing is actually not very strong. And then in the next episode, I looked at one of the principal seers that Christine relied upon in writing the book. His name was Father Michel Rodrigue, as I said. And I did an investigation of him, and I concluded this man is a fabulist, meaning he is not telling the truth about a variety of things, including his own life history. He either is deliberately lying or deliberately exaggerating in a way that amounts to lying, or he is delusional and does not accurately remember his own life history. But one way or another, we have a disordered process going on with him that leads him to be unreliable in a demonstrable, provable way. He subsequently was denounced by both of his bishops because he's incardinated in one Canadian diocese, but he lives in another, and both of his bishops issued statements warning people against him. Yet he's one of the principal sources that Christine was relying on. So I have to say that I am not favorably impressed by the book. And if you'd like more information on why, I believe it's episodes 122 and 123 of Mysterious World. You could find them by going to mysterious.fm/122 and mysterious.fm/123.
Betty, thank you very much. As you probably heard me say, there's lots of folks on the line, so I'm going to keep moving. But thank you for the call. Logan in Nampa, Idaho, listening on Salt and Light Radio. Logan, you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Logan. I enjoyed your movie. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for being here and all you do. I have a question concerning fasting. So I'm doing an Exodus 90 challenge with some of my brothers. Shout out to Andrew and Nico. But we are really focusing on fasting on Wednesdays and Fridays. And I understand that's something that we should do as Catholics anyway, but specifically meat as well. Why do we practice that, and what is the benefit of us practicing fasting and fasting from meat on Wednesdays and Fridays?
Okay, well, when you say that this is something Catholics should do anyway, that's true on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. It is not something that the church has said we should do the rest of the time. It's something that you're welcome to do as a spiritual discipline, but it is not obligatory, and we should not look down on people who do not choose to do it regularly. Because it's a matter of Christian liberty, and we shouldn't be looking down on fellow Christians for how they exercise their liberty. So just a warning in that regard. In terms of its significance, well, fasting is denying oneself something that you could otherwise have, and that it's thus a kind of a sacrifice. And so by sacrificing having a meal when you otherwise could have one, you're making a sacrifice to God if you're doing it for a spiritual purpose, like you want to be closer to God, you want to grow in holiness. Also, the sacrifice of not eating because we have an inbuilt impulse to eat is something that is a good form of training. It can not only help you cure habits like overeating, it also can help you develop a transferable skill to where if I can say no to my desire in this area, maybe I can say no to my desire in other areas where I might be tempted to sin. And so it can be of assistance in growing in holiness. When it comes to meat specifically, meat is a unique food substance for humans. We are omnivores, meaning we can eat both plants and animals. But animal food is very high calorie. It contains lots of protein and lots of fat, and fat makes things taste better. And it also contains certain nutrients that are very difficult to get from plants. So meat is a very rich food. It is also hard to obtain because you can't just grow it on the ground like you could grow wheat or something. Or, you know, you can't just pluck it off of a tree because it comes from animals. And they have to eat plants in order to grow the meat that we want to eat. So meat by its nature is harder to get in evolutionary terms than plant food is. And consequently, it is more highly valued, both for its nutritional and for its gustatory qualities, how much people enjoy eating it. It is people tend to enjoy having a burger more than they do a piece of lettuce. And so because of the sensual experience of eating meat and it's the greater difficulty in acquiring it and all of that, it is a high value food. And by denying ourselves a high value food, we are making a greater sacrifice. And that enhances the benefit of the spiritual discipline. And that's why on Ash Wednesday and the Fridays of Lent, we also abstain from eating meat. It different than fasting, but it's, in your terms, fasting from meat. It's more commonly called abstaining from meat, but that's the basic reason for it, because it's a form of sacrifice we can use to grow closer to God.
And Logan, that brings us to our break, so I will leave it there. God bless you as you undertake this spiritual undertaking. And we will take our break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN offers the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass live every morning at 8 Eastern and provides you with daily readings to follow along and enrich your experience. To be sure you don't miss out on the daily Mass or to get access to previous recordings, we can send a link to your email inbox every day. It's easy. Visit EWTN.com and click subscribe. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it is Open Forum. We're going to just keep working our way through these calls because we got a lot of them, and Nancy in Utah is next. Nancy's watching on YouTube. Glad you're here with us, Nancy. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
All right.
Yeah, it was me who was confused about you're in there last week, too, when I called in. Hey, I have an online acquaintance named Christian Miller, who uses a Celtic cross and to make a sextant. It's a kind of a cross and then a circle in it, and he's got some websites, and he's on Facebook. I wondered if you've ever heard of him, because he comes back, he postulates that from ancient Paleolithic and Neolithic hunters, gatherers, seafarers, and up through the Knights Templar, used this type of instrument to build buildings and to cross the oceans. And then another thing, his first name is spelled C-R-I-C-H-T-O-N, and he's Crichton Edward McGregor Miller. Have you ever heard of him, and does his first name stand for Christ? Because that's what he's said at times.
Wow.
Okay, well, let's see. The name Crichton, I am familiar with Crichton, and I could see where it could be something like Christ's Town, that could get contracted to Crichton. However, according to the web search I just did, the boy's baby name Crichton can, depending on how it's spelled, mean border or boundary settlement or from the hilltop. So it doesn't appear that, despite the cry on the front of it, that it's related to Christ etymologically. So that's what I have to say about that. In terms of have I heard of him, I'm afraid the answer is no. There have been seafarers dating back to certainly the Neolithic, and I'm sure the Paleolithic as well. Sailors frequently use instruments to help them navigate, you know, sextants and things like that. I don't know how much evidence we have for the use of such instruments that far back in history. We do have evidence of people crossing oceans certainly by the Neolithic and I believe by the Paleolithic, where you have, you know, people arriving, for example, in islands in the South Pacific. I mean, the native Aborigines got to Australia at least 60,000 years ago, and they probably had to cross some water to do that. And in that part of the world, in the South Pacific, there are some amazing feats of stellar navigation where, you know, guys would get out in these canoes and be able to use the stars to navigate, to go distant places and find them accurately in their inter-island commerce. But I don't know the extent to which they used instruments like sextants in doing that. That's something I would have to investigate further. Obviously, given the way a sextant is structured, you could build one out of a Celtic cross if you wanted. Celtic crosses not only have the long vertical staff and the shorter horizontal staff, they also have a circle around them, and that circle you could mark it off in degrees or other units of measurement and use it in the fashion of a sextant. But I would want to see evidence regarding it being used in particular historical periods.
Nancy, I'm going to leave that there. I do hope it was helpful to you. Thank you very much for the call. I've got next on the line Vincent in British Columbia, Canada. Vincent, thanks very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi there.
Hi, Vincent.
With regards to a conditional baptism, my fiancée mm-hmm. is coming into the church at Easter.
Awesome.
She was baptized, kind of like bathtub baptism, by her grandmother, who is Catholic. So most mm-hmm. likely legitimate baptism.
Mm-hmm.
Would she need to go to confession? Because, yeah, I'm just wondering if she needs to go to confession at her coming into the church or not.
Well, if she's committed any mortal sins since her first baptism, the answer would be yes. And it's typical in cases of conditional baptism that immediately before you do the conditional baptism, the person goes to confession to take care of precisely this problem. Because if the person is already validly baptized, the conditional baptism is not going to change anything. It's not going to remit any sins because baptism can be done only once. And so if the first baptism was valid, then she needs to be forgiven of the sins that she's committed since then, and that would be the sacrament of confession. So the typical way it's done when you have a conditional baptism situation is the person goes to confession first, often immediately before or at least shortly before the baptism, and then they get the conditional baptism. That's the way with me. I had a baptism in the Protestant community whose validity I doubted, and so I insisted when I came into the Catholic Church on having a conditional baptism. And I also recognized, okay, in case my first baptism was valid, I need to go to confession. And so I went to confession, and then I received the conditional baptism.
Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, no, that's what I suspected. The advice she's getting right now is that she doesn't from the pastor.
Hmm.
Do you have any references that I can bring to him?
Well, there are moral and pastoral theology handbooks that one could consult, but I would tend to handle it more simply and just say, I really want to do this. I want to go to confession first and receive a conditional absolution, and that will help me be at peace. And if that's if most priests should be willing to respond to that kind of an argument, if the priest isn't willing to respond to that, if that doesn't solve the problem, then I'd say I'm uncertain, I'm uncomfortable about this. I think we should check with the bishop. And between taking those two steps, first just saying this is what I want, this will help me feel comfortable, that's likely to take care of the problem right there. And if it doesn't, the next step logically would be appealing to the bishop, although you could also call us off the air and we might be able to find you an additional print resource that you could use.
And I'll tell you what, if you want to call us off the air, that's fine. You can send an email to radio@catholic.com. There's various ways to get in touch with us, we'd be happy to help further that. But let's see, follow that course that Jimmy recommended, and we'll see how that turns out. And what wonderful news, too, for coming to the church. So thank you very much for the call, Vincent. I'm kind of moving because I want to get Vanessa on in Burbank, California. She's been waiting, and Vanessa's watching on YouTube. Vanessa, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy and Cy. I have a question. How would one reply to what was the point of the temptations of Christ if he could not sin and therefore he would not give into those temptations?
So one of the things to be aware of is that the word that's in Greek that's translated temptation in a lot of our English Bibles also can be translated as testing. And so it's ambiguous whether in Greek, whether the devil was literally tempting Jesus or whether he was testing Jesus. And that opens one possibility for what the point may have been. The devil may not have been sure if Jesus is the one. He may have known the Son of God is coming into the world sometime around now, but not be sure of exactly who it is. And then he, in learning about Jesus, may have had suspicions that he might be the Son of God. And so let's find out, because if he is the all-holy Son of God, he shouldn't give in to temptations. So let's really lay some on him and see if he breaks or not. If he breaks and gives in to the temptations, that means he's not the Son of God. But if he resists even the devil's most powerful temptations, then, okay, he's the Son of God. I better watch out for this guy. He's the one I need to focus on. I need to do what I can to try to thwart his ministry. So that may have been the purpose of the devil attempting to tempt or test Christ. He was trying to find out, is Jesus of Nazareth the Christ or not? There's also another possibility, which would be that the devil knew full well that Jesus of Nazareth was the Christ and was the Son of God, and that he was not going to give in to these temptations. But the devil's just malicious. He just wanted to mess with Jesus. He just wanted to put pressure on him and, you know, make his life harder. And so in addition to the fasting and praying that Jesus was doing out in the desert, which is not a very comfortable mode of existence, the devil wanted to just pour some more suffering on him by hitting him with temptation as well, even though he knew full well he was never going to give in to it. So those, to my mind, would seem to be the two leading theories for explaining this. Either the devil didn't know that Jesus was the Messiah and was testing him to find out if he was, or the devil knew he was the Messiah and was just being malicious. There's one more possibility, which is the devil was just stupid and thought that maybe Jesus would give in and that would thwart Jesus's plans. You know, like if I'm able to get the Son of God to morally sully himself, he won't be a suitable sacrifice for the world anymore. So maybe he was just dumb and thought that Jesus might give in. But if I assume that last one is not the case, because the devil, being from heaven, should know better than that. But then, as they say, sin makes you stupid, so who knows for sure.
Vanessa, thank you very much for the call. I'm so glad we were able to get you on before we had to finish there. Jimmy Akin has been our guest. Tomorrow, as on every Friday, a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. This one on, do you say dowsing or dowsing? Dowsing.
No. Dowsing.
Dowsing,
it's
yeah.
An English word, so it's got this S for Z sound in there.
That's weird. That came up twice in one. Yeah, dowsing. All right. And you can find that at mysterious.fm or just put into your Google machine Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, thanks. It was quick, but a fun hour. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Syke Ellett.
That does it for us. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.